So what we're going to do today is to talk about user or customer models and personas, two things which make a lot of sense to me as being very closely related, but which probably have never before been in the same lecture because they're really taught from very different points of view with very different techniques, even though they have essentially some of the same goals. So I'm going to begin today by motivating this idea of user or customer models. Talk about different ways in which you can learn about user goals and preferences to essentially to build that model of what a customer is trying to do. We'll talk about the methods and, more importantly, the limitations of what I will pompously call unidimensional preference judgment, mainly the way that most people do questions in surveys and interviews about the choices or preferences or goals that customers or users might have. And I'll introduce a technique very vague, very quickly and glibly about multidimensional preference judgments, which have been pioneered by people like Dan McFadden, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics for this technique that he invented on finding a very, very elegant and powerful way to infer rich information about preferences with a very economical way of having customers make judgments, essentially of pairwise choices. And then we'll talk about personas as the kind of alternate universe, the way it's taught in typically in user-centered design context, and we'll compare those two techniques for building models of the user or customer. So I don't think anyone would argue with the need to do this, because you can never satisfy every requirement that has been expressed, as you'll see as you try to systematize and prioritize your requirements. You've got to find ways to figure out what the most important things are, and presumably that should be related to the things that are most important or valuable to your most influential or valuable customers or users. So you essentially have to segment your requirements as well as segment your customers so you can have some reasonable selection of both. One reason I want to be explicit about this is because too often when people talk about the user, they say that in this kind of undifferentiated way, as if everyone who might use your system or service or product is the same. And that clearly isn't true. Users have very different experiences, attitudes, roles, biases, and so on. And it's easy to fall into the bad habit of thinking that you as a designer or as any front stage person, a marketing person, a salesperson, any kind of front stage customer facing employee of a service system will act on the basis of assumed qualities or attributes or goals of this kind of undifferentiated blob of a user that will be wrong. And so it's important to have something explicit as a model, especially you don't just pretend that you are that model, because it's also very easy to let yourself fall into the role of the user and assume that you can then use yourself as a model of the customer you're trying to build or serve. Now, this is not an alien concept, because we do user models all the time. We naturally, and without explicit effort, make user models. And we have, in fact, my wife is famous to me for always saying that we just run the model and predict what someone's going to be doing, what their action will be, what their behavior will be, when you sort of as a way to think about the consequences of the decision you want to make. So you run the model as a way to predict how people will act to something you do. And of course, this is something which we have rich enough in our heads, multidimensional enough in our heads, that we can say that, gee, Lube is not himself today. Right? Which means the model we have of him is being violated by whatever he's doing today. So maybe he's just bent out of shape over something. Maybe he's irrationally exuberant about something. Either case, he's not the regular guy we know. Right? So that kind of phrase, he's not being himself today, means that the model you have of some person is not being confirmed because of their particular behavior. So this idea that you have that kind of predictability, you know, means that you have some model of how they're going to operate. And this, as Gruden points out in his paper, there's a continuum of these user models from sort of group stereotypes like, gee, all Asians are the striving students, things like that, right? Based on, say, cultural differences or things like that. Group stereotypes are stereotypes because there may be some grain of truth in them that lets us predict coarsely on one bit of information some possible behavior of some person who belongs to that group. It could be some set of traits we attribute to people, like, oh, they're an honest person, or they're shy, or things like that. It could be more nuanced, where you say, well, this person has evolved over time because they have some more intermediate or shorter term goal, like they're saving to go through college, or they're trying to go on a vacation, or things like that. They also have specific predictability because they follow cultural or other situational norms about how to behave in some situations. Like, we know what a restaurant script is, or a classroom script is, or how you interact in other kinds of situations. And again, we can say that person's being rude, or they're being, you know, too passive, or they're not playing by the rules. Because again, we have some sense of what normative behavior is in some context. You know, when people walk into the checkout line with 25 things and they're in the short line, you get mad because they're breaking the rules, right? They're not acting as sort of good members of society are. Okay? We may have very specific information about people. Like, I know that they went to Berkeley, they play basketball, they're married, they like comic books, and they live in the Mission District. And I can predict something about that person, okay, on the basis of that. If I say they live in the Castro, that tells me something, maybe perhaps something different. They live in Forest Hill, they live in Knob Hill. You say, oh, I know about that person. I can sort of make some inferences about that person based on some of those things. Fill in some of the other characteristics, which may be wrong, but again, it's a kind of user model that we're going to use to predict some kind of behavior. Okay? But, you know, that's essentially implicit or automatic user modeling we do. This is because of the way we act as members of some culture or society. We also can do more explicit modeling of people. We can do it by observing them, doing ethnographic activities by watching them or interviewing them to sort of understand their goals and behavior, what makes them tick. We can have them in the laboratory and do experiments. How would you behave given these possible situations? We can study what they do when they go buy things. We can look at their transaction data. We can interview them. Again, it's important to understand someone's user goals and preferences for some supposed class of users. It's also important to interview dissatisfied informer people in that class. So people who stop being your customer are important to interview as well, as people who are your customers, to understand what makes customers tick. Focus groups, I think, are becoming discredited, I think, as a technique for learning about potential offerings or services, products, because they have real bad sampling biases. You tend to get people who have lots of time in their hands, who want a few bucks or a couple of coupons, and they want to come together and they talk about things, and they're easily hijacked by people with certain kinds of behaviors, like they want to be the leaders of groups and so on. So we tend not to do those as much as we used to learn about classes of people or reactions to possible offerings. And then we can do surveys, and I'll talk a bit about surveys because most of what we know about surveys is probably wrong, or ineffective, or worse. Experimentation is something which we are doing a lot of these days, and not in the way you might think of, because we are doing less and less of bringing people into the laboratory to do controlled experiments, partly because we have new kinds of services and offerings which are now more amenable to doing kind of continuous experimentation, because they're delivered in environments where that's possible. So we have things like software as a service or hosted kind of applications, where we can essentially run online experiments where we say every 100th person gets a different page of something. We've manipulated some kind of change in the page or in the offering. And we can see whether that changes behavior, like does it increase the sales or the click-through or some other kind of measure which you view as desirable. Really quite amazing. These are in fact done almost automatically. Companies like Google or Yahoo or Microsoft that have big machines for running online services literally run controlled experiments all the time automatically, where they simply can try, generate some set of possible variations of some offering, and then just see which ones make a difference. Okay, let's talk about transactions. Yeah?
The beta test and everything Google has been for a number of 2-3 years. What impact does that experimentation have on the user? It's kind of like the user's no longer being observed kind of independently. They know they're in a trial, if you will. So does their behavior change
Well, you read the paper about the gap model of service quality, okay? What would being told, this isn't really prime time stuff, it's not really the final offering, what would that do to your expectations about it?
Right, it would take it down a notch.
Take it down. So in some sense, it's a very clever way for some companies to say, this is likely to be less than perfect, but you knew that, so it's okay. Don't, you know, in some ways you sort of deliberately are downplaying expectations. Even if it's really your best offer, you may call it a beta because that way people won't be so angry at you if it fails. Especially if they trained you for the last 5 years to think that. So I'm a little skeptical of continuous betas in that sense because some of them may already be their best and final offer, but they get you to think that it's not, then maybe you'll be more accommodating. I'm more willing to give them feedback and things like that, which feedback is king, right? You want to get people to tell you what they think. And that's often hard to do because, you know, what's in it for you, right? If you feel like your feedback is just being smeared in with some gigantic pile of feedback versus they're really trying to find something customized or personalized for you. So it depends a little bit on how you perceive the situation. That's why situations where you are making a more explicit bargain are often more interesting because you're saying, I'm trading this for this. Okay? Now I hope that you think that. When you go to the supermarket, you say, I am going to give you my loyalty card number because it's going to give me discounts. Okay? You're making a trade. You say, I'm selling my personal data for some discount. Now, maybe as I have, you may use your wife's dog as the name. My card on it says Tilly Samuelson. I always thought, that's my wife. It's my wife's brother's dog. Okay. So Tilly Samuelson buys a lot of expensive wine at Safeway, and you know, it's kind of funny. She also buys dog food in Seattle. Okay. But they know that, but you know, those things probably average out over enough people because enough people are just doing it and they really want the coupons and stuff, and they're probably being more accurate. I suspect, I don't know this for a fact, but if I were Safeway and I were in the marketing department, I would look at the quality of the data I get and make better offers to people who give me better data. That's a way to encourage real loyalty. So Tilly's data is kind of noisy. She's buying wine in California and dog food in Seattle at the same moment. So they probably give me fewer worse suggestions than they would if someone just over the way down the middle. I think I would. Because I'd be more sensitive saying this is a good customer who's really trying to make the bargain work with me. But again, I don't know. There's a difference in how willing you are to self-identify. That's an important thing to get at in your designs. But are you providing the right incentives? Remember we talked about that a little bit in personalization about what incentives are you providing? And again, do you expect or would you demand that your business establishment keep track of your previous transactions? I mean, what business providers or service providers to you, would you be mad if they didn't keep track of your previous encounters? Your bank, right? Your doctor, your dentist, right? Your car repair? I mean, who else? It's people who, you know, there's sort of a kind of service provider you'd want to keep track of your previous encounters. Now, there are people who are being very clever about that, and they're not telling you, but they know they can provide you better service if they do. And so I learned the other day that there are some of the car wash companies have put barcodes on your cars, okay, like under the bumpers and stuff. So when your car comes through on the car wash, they can read your bumper and know you've been there before. Okay, things like that. Now, is that a problem? It's a question for Deirdre Mulligan or Eric or Chris Hufnagel, not for me. I suspect it's legal if it's not explicitly prohibited by law. You know, I mean, do you want them to keep track of you? If you get a coupon that says, congratulations, Marianne, you've been to our store 10 times. Here's a free car wash. You say, this is great. I didn't even know I was counting myself. And they love me so much, they're counting my car washes. God, I'm going to be a loyal customer to those people. Suppose it was, gee, we've noticed you've been in the sleazy graduate bar on Claremont at college 10 times in the last 2 weeks. Has a free beer on the house next time you show up. It's like, Jesus, that's creepy, right?
It seems that if you're going 10 times to to a particular college because you're already a loyal customer, that maybe you don't need an extra incentive to go there. What I would...
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, so...
Pick a number. What number do you like? 5?
I mean, maybe that's not the point. Maybe the point is that there's... I mean, that's not the concern. The concern was, is this legal or what we'll share? Right?
Yeah.
Be bothered by this. I don't think people would be bothered by it if they got free stuff out of it. I also think that it's in the company's interest to reward people who already come very often. It seems like the information would be used to some sort of cross, you know, kind of cross-business promotional stuff, or you might be concerned that the vegan car wash, you know, place is going to scan your barcode, and they have some agreement, and you go get advertising links to your press, but they'll go with some other information, sort of the sure amount of information that's about, or that's about you that's out there that is the concern. So the argument
yeah, absolutely.
You get free stuff doesn't take away from the, like, feeling people might feel.
I have my icky moments too. I just, you know, maybe they're different than you. Right? I mean, it's just that, and that's part of what your designs have to be sensitive to. What kinds of customers will feel icky about what kinds of things? There may be people who love those coupons. You know, they cut those coupons, then they can't wait to get tracked. All right. Versus other people who never use coupons and would try to avoid. They try to obfuscate their Safeway card by using Tilly, the dog. Of course, it says Tilly Samuelson, which is my wife's name. Oh my God! I should probably be more careful. I should call it Tilly, you know, Tilly McPherson or something like that. You know, I could just use somebody else's name. But that's, you know, again, you go to a museum. I mean, do you think the museum should know what exhibit you look at? Museum people. You see, the same team has to fight about this. You guys can fight about these service priorities. That's good. I like that. See? So, Jessica's more willing to have her behavior tracked in the museum because she wants to get museum swag, whereas you don't want it. Right? They might. Here's your replica King Tut bust for coming to the Museum of Fine Arts for the 12th time this year. I mean, I don't know. This is a key question, you know. What things, you know, do we know enough about you as a person to model you in a way that will satisfy your goals? Obviously, we don't yet because you're fighting with us. So, yeah.
I guess one question I have is, if they could put a barcode on your car, then what keeps them from putting, like, a barcode on you? Is that sort of something on your skin while you're at the museum, and then you just go to remove it so your car can't really tell? So it's just like, what's personal property?
Yeah. How do you know that when they put those little things in the bar when you're at night, or when the nightclub, or there's a concert, it's not really more permanent than you think? They've got an indelible thing on your hand that they've done so you can go back in the bar at night. It's actually going to last forever. Could be a great movie about that, huh? All right. The bar that uses the special kind of thing that then can track you. All right. Okay. Let's talk about surveys. Surveys have been called structured conversations between strangers. I love that phrase. Again, they're trying to find ways to get information about you by having a precisely designed conversation. Businesses routinely do this, occasionally to provide value to you. I'm being a little sarcastic there because, as I agree with Luba, there's oftentimes when they're not trying to meet your interest, they're trying to collect data about you, like those little warranty cards that you get when you buy something. Never fill them out because they're not required to get the warranty. In fact, the law prohibits them to be needed to get the warranty of your product, but they act like you should fill this form out about how many children you have under the age of 4 who go to preschool and what they wear to preschool, and do they wear a certain branded kind of apparel when they go to preschool. It's really not relevant when you buy a toaster, and yet people fill those things out all the time because they get the card and they think they have to fill it out. So there's lots of methodology and lore about this, but if you get to the core, surveys basically ask people questions about their preferences for particular features or dimensions of offerings. And again, many of them are done in a really bad way. I'm going to show you some bad ways and try to motivate some good ways. So here is a typical survey question that you might get. This is kind of a neutrally phrased one. Okay, the president is doing a good job and you have to strongly agree versus strongly disagree. the Congress is doing a good job, Secretary of Defense is doing a good job, you can't tell who's making the survey, right? But suppose it said the president is doing a good job given the trying circumstances that he's been put in because he inherited a mess. All right? It's going to get a different set of responses than the president doing a good job despite the fact he's fighting an opposition democratically controlled Congress. Okay? Or the scale could be skewed in a way that would beg the question, a certain skew it in a certain way where it's not fair and balanced. Okay? But again, as an example, this kind of 5 or 7 point scale is very common. It's called a Likert or Likert scale. Most very commonly used. You'll be taught this technique if you take a class like 213 or 214, much to my dismay, because there's some fundamental problems with this technique. One of which it tends to use labels on the values. The 1 to 5 will often have labels on them, and is very common for people to overinterpret them, both as respondents and as analyzers, to treat the data as sort of more metric than it really is. That is, that the analyses you do with the data are often sort of more than the data justifies. I mean, this is theory of measurement I'm not going to go into, but essentially, how much can you do with this number? Can you say, well, there's 5 different bins, and the most commonly filled out bin is, or the average rating was? And that kind of question reflects the underlying measurement properties of the technique, and they may in fact be less rigorous than you think. So, for example, if I say, what's the most commonly made answer, or what's the middle, the median answer, that assumes very little about the underlying metric properties of the data. Whereas if I say, what's the standard deviation of the responses, I'm assuming that people have used that thing as a numerical scale with kind of properties that are about consistency and kind of homogeneity across all parts of the scale, which may not be true given the way the question is framed on the scale. So, for example, if I give you this question, okay, how often do you smoke cigarettes? You know, the values on this scale are carving up the range of possible smoking in ways that would make it hard to imagine that if one-fourth of the people said never and one-fourth of the people said more than 5 a day, you could say, well, let's average that to get 2.5 or something like that. That makes no sense, right? And yet, that's what you're doing when you take data that's collected with these kinds of scales with words on them to label the points on the scale. So it's not a great technique. And any high school student who's ever taken 202 should be able to tell me why. Because you've got a category system and the categories are biased and they may not be carving up the space in a way which works. Okay? So I've been doing surveys since, I don't know, my first ones were probably done about 1974 or 5 when I was a graduate student doing research about various things. I started using a technique that my statistics professor recommended called direct magnitude estimation. And it's a really interesting technique which has much stronger intellectual foundations based on lots of rigorous research about the way people make perceptual judgments. And the basic idea is this, that instead of having a labeled scale, which essentially carves up some scale into sort of spaces with sort of points on it, we're essentially putting verbal labels on certain points on the scale, which distorts the way you use the scale. Okay, you say, here is some dimension, give me a direct estimation of some value on this scale. And this does something really interesting. What it does is it eliminates a lot of the source of biases. People actually use the whole scale in a much more continuous way. You get what amounts to metric data. And especially when you do something very clever that I was taught, again, 1974, it used to be critical when I had printed surveys before the age of computers. Okay, and that is, that 100-point scale is a magic for a lot of reasons. One is that people seem to be able to think 0 to 100 and mark that scale, even though they're not looking at numbers, but 0 to 100 is sort of a nice sort of thing, right? But better than that, when it's 100 millimeters, Now you're about 4 inches on the piece of paper. You slap your ruler down and go, 63. And then you measure the number of millimeters and you have a number. And people use the entire scale. Okay? And so instead of being stuck into five bins, people will naturally use the entire range in a way which is just much better. Okay? You're not saying 100 is this and 0 is this or 27 is this. You're saying here's the scale. Pick a point on the scale which gives you your estimation of that person, of that rating. And it gives less noisy data. Yeah. Abe.
So when you give it to the person, you show the 0 and the 100, or you actually just leave the line and say place.
You can do either. That doesn't even make much difference. I actually like it because then you sort of give people something that they think they're making them. You know. It might be better not to have the numbers at all, because you just sort of directly reacted to it. The point is, you're not labeling any regions of it or points on it, you're just not saying super good or not so good. So, yes. Well, okay. Let me think of a good answer to that. In that case, you might say. Let me think about it. Yeah, this is for qualitative things, right? But again, but the smoking answer example is bad because it carves up the space in funny ways anyway, right? You want to avoid even on a numerical scale. So if I'm smoking, how many cigarettes do I smoke in a day? You know, 0, 1 to 2, 3 to 4, more than 5. Okay, I get different data when I say 0, 1 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 20, 20 to 40, 50, or more than 40. Right? Because this one sort of says, "My God, smoking more than 5 is a bad on one end of the scale." Right? This says, "Oh, you're basically on the good end of the smoking spectrum with 5." You're on the low end of smoking, right? You're implying by the way you carved up the scale, right? Yeah. That's what's magic about it. It's like when I say, "How bright is this? Is this light?" Okay, and people will go 71. Okay, they make good judgments over a much wider range than if I say very bright, little, pretty bright. I mean, they just do better judgments. This is sort of empirical.
But aren't we kind of interpreting if the average on the president is doing a good job at 71? Like, what does 71 mean? Like, that's just. Don't we have to put our own interpretation in there? I mean,
yeah, you you have more data to work with. Okay, you'll see. We've got to touch what the distribution is, right? Because if you have 5 categories, okay, you might be evenly spread. But you could get a 71, but you could have, you know, looks like this. All right, you have lovers and haters, right? But if you have, you know, 3 bins, you may not see this. So having a wider scale gives you more richer data.
I think you're going to have to turn that into information that you can use in a more, you know, whether it's like for marketing or documentation. So how do you say, like, you know, 4 out of 5 people think the president is doing a good job? Like, it makes it hard.
Usually that's lying anyway, right? Because they've cheated. They made the scale in a way that's actually they couldn't get the answer they want. It's a good question. Yeah.
Just kind of building on that, I think this is important. You need a large sample size. Or you have to think about sample size, maybe this is kind of a question, right? But the thing about the buckets is, you know, you might, if you're trying to partition people into different buckets, maybe that's what you're doing, then maybe it's useful. But for something like this, it might help to have, you know, a pretty large sample size.
Yeah. Again, this is... You know, I want to make a point that you're seeing that there's clearly more than just the one way to do it. And this clearly has motivated you to think that there may be some better properties, and that's all I wanted to do with this simple example. But in general, the fundamental problem with one-dimensional judgments of any kind is that things are not one-dimensional, okay? When you actually have an offering of a product or service, there's going to be multiple dimensions, and sort of trying to pull out one dimension at a time tends to distort judgments on that one dimension. in a way which tends to overestimate people's preference for it. Because it doesn't get you to think about the trade-offs that are inherent when there's multidimensionality in some offering. So think of it as you want to ask questions about dimensions in context of some other dimension, because that's always important. If I say, how important is price to you? Oh, price is pretty important. Well, how important is features of something? Pretty important. How important is quality? Pretty important. Well, yeah. What's important is the trade-off between those dimensions, and that doesn't come out of a unidimensional question. Okay? So obviously, you know, I love it because it's cheap, but it falls apart tomorrow. Or I love it because it's cheap, but it's dangerous. I'm not going to die using this product. Or it's great, it's high quality, but I can't afford it. Or it's offered by a company that I despise. Okay? Somehow, asking questions in a unidimensional way misses an awful lot about what really drives people's behavior and preferences. Especially since every design context has additional dimensions. So if I say, what are the most important criteria you need to decide which course to take next semester? There are some specialty features that are in your decision space, like, right, not just, do I need this to graduate, but is it the time of day I want to wake up in the morning? Or is the professor a terrible instructor? I wait till somebody good teaches this class. Or, you know, I want to take it when it'll fit better in my, I'll be able to interview better if I know some of the buzzwords. I better take it earlier rather than later in my professional career, right? Think about it. What determines where to go on vacation, right? People are not saying, well, gas mileage, right? Or is it a safe place? Are the terrorists going to blow me up when I get there? So there's a lot of things that, you know, that just asking simple questions about, do you like Paris? Well, hell yeah, I like Paris, but compared to what? Okay? Can I afford to go to Paris? Okay? So you want to have this more complicated question space, and, you know, we have to find ways to get at this idea that you're asking questions really not one at a time, but because people are always asking questions themselves as part of a bundle, but you're not getting it. Well, if you just ask questions one at a time, you're ignoring the fact they really think of it as a bundle. So how do you get them to actually think of things as a bundle of features? Well, you ask them questions about bundles of features. It's pretty obvious. Okay? And the challenge is to do that in a way which doesn't require just an enormous number of questions. So if I said, gee, there's 10 possible features of this product or service, and what are all the possible combinations of them? That's a lot of questions to ask. Okay? But making that tractable is worth a lot of money in terms of insight, which is why the guy that invented it got the Nobel Prize for it. It actually was worthwhile. Okay? And he'd actually done it. It wasn't like he was thinking of it, he'd actually done it. It actually works. So this idea of discrete choice modeling or preference modeling essentially is saying, how do I infer the dimensions of choice and the relative weights on those dimensions? Okay? In ways that I can then identify people with similar preferences and do all kinds of very clever things about understanding their preferences, all done with magical math. Okay? So, Dan McFadden won the 2000 Nobel Prize, Berkeley professor in economics, okay? Invented these techniques which effectively let you, here's how it works. So, you first start by saying, what are the possible dimensions or drivers that I might want to be testing here? You might learn those by asking people or by looking at the behavior, by doing, you know, competitive analysis or doing a literature review, finding some possible things that might be important to people. And you say, well, on what range could I possibly build a product? Or, maybe I can't even build it, but if I could build it, would there be demand for it? So I can even invent hypothetical offerings this way. Okay? What if I could have a car which would get 1,000 miles per gallon? What would you be willing to pay for it? For example, right? As long as it wasn't like, you know, weighed 2 pounds, it was unsafe to drive because it had nothing around it except for the seat and the engine, right? So, you know, could I imagine an offering which was acceptable but which has features which you can't imagine having today? So you can invent these kinds of possible offerings as well. The idea is you then create kind of configurations of values on these different dimensions and then say, okay, which of these would you prefer? door number A or door number B, kind of, right? And it's done in a way that because of this black magic statistical stuff that's underneath it, which says, let's generate the optimal questions which will get at identifying which of these dimensions are really important, you can ask 20 or 30 questions and identify people's preferences on five dimensions. So it's really amazing in terms of statistical leverage, because it's a tiny fraction of the maybe 1,000th of the possible combination, and you're able to identify what their preferences are. Okay? So here's an example of two possible online stores which differ in the kind of customer support they have, the detail of product description they have, whether there's online shopping assistance, whether there's offline support, whether it's a recommendation system, all these different kind of things you might have in an online shopping system. You say, which of these would you prefer? Very complicated choice space. You know, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 dimensions of these two different stores. You give people 20 of these pairs, and you learn, aha, that they really like customer support. It's really important to people. Customer service is very important to people. In any combination, they really value customer support the most. It's a key feature in the store. Or they really think that having good guarantees is important because they don't trust online vendors. Maybe different people have different preferences. Wow, you're identifying categories of possible buyers this way. Okay? So as a customer, you look at some of these pairs, and you say, which of these do I prefer, or they're both unacceptable to me, or I might say, here's what you currently have, which of these two possibilities would you be willing to trade for? Or would you be willing to trade for either of these? Or say, which is best and which is worst? Pretty simple things. But you're making a judgment about a real-sounding thing in a way that will, through the black magic of the underlying statistics, will identify essentially your valued space. So here's a really good example. On the right side, you have the customer's current. This is like, say, this is your mobile phone company, your telephone company, saying, here's your current offering. Okay, you have the following configuration of phone and functions and price and carrier and, you know, contract and so on. You're willing to trade for either of these phones. Which of these would you trade for? Okay? Really powerful stuff. Way more than on a 1.7 scale. How important is the usage of the phone you make? How important is the price? How important is the weight of the phone? If you ask people questions one at a time like that, you tend to overestimate the preferences they have for any one feature. They tend to say things are better than they really are in context. Well, so what, you say, if we have a consistent overestimate of their preferences? What happens if people consistently overestimate how important features are to them? What do manufacturers and service providers do?
They put too many
features in things. Because customers say, well, I like this. Of course you like it in the abstract. What are you willing to trade off against for it? So having this more complex preference model is really helpful and helps make sort of the minimal satisfactory things and eliminate a lot of feature bloat, which is often a cause of usability problems and so on. So in some ways, usability people are their own worst enemies if they ask these kind of survey questions about how much do you like price and how much do you like this, because then they're going to get bloated products that have too much of that stuff in it. Okay, so that's what the customer does, answer questions like these. You can see how this could be generated by some online application. Okay, which one do you choose? And you just sit there for half an hour and it generates 30 possibilities and you're done. And you've now told them an enormous amount about your preferences and it wasn't seem like that part of a deal to do. Okay? So what happens now is that all the sort of serious statistical crunching goes on, and we identify which preferences are the most important, their relative weights, and we can identify clusters of people with similar preferences. Okay? And we can say, aha, maybe we can figure out what kind, give these people a label because of some identifying characteristics of this particular people that have this cluster of preferences. So there's some great examples, I think, in the paper, or a paper that I read like it. Here you see the analysis of different possible dimensions of a hamburger concept store. Okay? And there's three different categories of customers: English to Spanish, Japanese. And this says that, gee, the Spanish folks really care a lot about the brand of the hamburgers. Whereas the Japanese don't care much about the brand, but the Japanese care relatively more about the variety offered by the store. On the other hand, there's a very nice culture by product interaction, because if you ask them about hot dogs, you know, all of a sudden, Japanese care a whole lot about the brand of a hot dog. They don't care about the brand of the hamburger, they care a lot about the brand of hot dogs. Who knew? Right? That there's this crossover. The Japanese care about hot dog brands and not about hamburger brands. You're never going to get that asking questions one at a time about, you know, how important is a brand to you. Because it's really the complex configuration and the rest of the features which is really helping us figure this out. Now, in, yes?
So, do you have the questions behind these results?
What?
Do
we
have the questions behind these
results? No, they probably showed a bunch of configurations. That here's a possible store that has, you know, it's got, offers 10 different kinds of hamburgers, you know, from Big Macs to double cheeseburgers to whatever else, to fish sandwiches. You have to, there's a relatively long wait because everything's made to order, but it's really good prices or whatever it is, right? So you say, which of these stores would you prefer to go to? All right, so it's like the cell phones where they've invented hypothetical stores, and then you make choices. And this is what's produced by the analysis. It's aha, here's the relative weighting of these dimensions by these different user groups. In fact, this particular thing is probably the less useful way to do it, because it's more useful to say, let's not start with the pre-existing thing. This may be useful in marketing different cultures, right? But more likely in some particular context, you want to figure out what are those clumps of people that have the same preferences. So we can market to those people in some context. And so what we'll do is try to figure out, not with pre-existing customer groups based on pre-existing kinds of characteristics like culture. We want to basically lump and split people till we find the right kinds of clumps. This is all technical terms, of course, lumping and splitting, right? But there really is this notion that the statistical goal you have is to optimize within group similarity and between group differences. So you wiggle around people in the groups until you find the groups which are the best fit, which means they're the smallest variation within the group and the biggest variation between the groups. Kind of makes sense. Like, think of that like least squares, but in a very high dimensional space, to find the right fit to the data. And this is really the traditional criterion for clustering things or people, to try to find maximal differences between clusters and minimal differences within clusters. Any of you done a lot of this? You probably have. Did I describe that fairly enough? I mean, I'm using a lot of technical jargon like clumping and lumping, but... So what have you done this for? Oh, sorry, you want to finish eating first? Okay, we'll come back to you. When you're ready to talk, you raise your hand again. Yeah, Amy.
In the meantime, about a month or so ago, the campus bookstore sent out a really long survey about every class that you're doing and every book that you've gotten for every class. And I couldn't figure out why they wanted to know all these details. And then this part of it made me realize I think they're trying to get into the electronic book business.
Could very well be. They want to market to different kinds of people.
Asking.
What kind of people would be willing to shop at the online bookstore versus the offline bookstore? Joan, you ready to talk now? Okay.
Considering the sort of customer segments of who's where, who would buy more.
We could imagine what likely clusters you're likely to find if you are trying to find. I mean, again, it's not the names, the point is who's in the cluster, right? So where do they live, what kind of people they are. Then we get the name of the cluster we've identified. But you can imagine there's kind of a environmentally conscious cluster that cares about electricity delivered one way. There could be people who are just cheap. It could be the libertarians who have a certain view of things, you know, where people have different values which will affect sort of after the fact the way to describe these different preference functions. So a typical one might be, here you see three kind of tough typical categories for purchases of some products. We have the gourmet buyers who say, I really care about the quality of the experience and the richness of the feature offering. That's really important to me. I'm not concerned about price. I'm rich. I don't care about price. I just want to have a good experience. Versus bargain hunters who say, all I care about is price. These people are just hard to sell to. Right? Because they don't have a particular hot button, but they're kind of stingy at the same time. But so you really can't give them a promotion to get them to come in. These people, you give them a promotion, they'll come and buy. These people, you say, you can have Thomas Keller will come and sign his cookbooks. Oh, I'm there. I want to have my Thomas Keller cookbook to show to my friends, and I'm obviously a food snob. Okay? So again, you'll find different clumps of people have been extracted based on these kinds of preference configurations. But there's more. Okay? If you have this stuff about people, you say, I now have a model of people. Okay? And I know about how they weight different dimensions. Okay? I might be able to simulate, to understand the elasticity of their preferences. Does anyone know what that means? Elasticity of preferences? Right. If some feature, if some value and some dimension changes, what will that do to the rest of your preference space? Most commonly asked questions about price, right? If I raise the price, how much will it change your demand for this thing? Are you price sensitive or are you price insensitive, right? These people are saying, you know, I'll pay $100 to have dinner, and if it goes to $120, that's okay. This person would say, no way am I going to pay $20. I was certainly not going to pay $20 more than I'm paying today. So these people have different functions that are over, that change their different differential elasticity with respect to price or some other dimension. So you say, gee, I'm currently selling the Toyota Prius at a certain price point to eco nuts, whoever buys Priuses. Okay, people don't care about, I want to be cool and have an environmental brand on my car and someone like to impress people. I'm a cool, environmentally conscious person or whatever people are that buy Priuses. I'm not one of them. All right? I wouldn't use such derogatory language that I was, right? Okay. So you're a Prius person, right? Toyota says, you know what? I wonder if we can get some of these people to buy Priuses if we kind of glam them up. Let's put like fancier seats in the Prius and see if we can attract people who currently drive fancier cars. Because Priuses are kind of stripped down in some ways, if you ask me. That contributes to their mileage. They're not very fancy inside, right? Leather seats in the Prius, it probably hurt his mileage a little bit, but would you get some of these people buying it? Style people, you know? Yeah.
This goes back to the thing about the bookstore. I accidentally said online books, which is kind of confusing there with the online books. I meant electronic books.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm trying to get a question if people would be willing to buy e-books instead of regular books.
All right. They're saying, given what your preferences are, are you willing to, you know, does online, is that a good feature or a bad feature, for example? That kind of they're trying to figure out. Okay? So anyway, this is the world of market science. Okay? And it's relatively new. It's like in the last 10 years and it's exploding in terms of this. It's really kind of smart math underneath to make these very efficient preference judgments to be able to do this kind of research. You know, 10 or 20 years at the most. Yeah.
So I'm the sort of person who does customer research surveys for fun.
Yeah.
And so I've done a lot of these, actually.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because some of the more extensive ones will follow this format where the first thing is on a 5 or 7 point scale, rate these different features. And then the second thing will be, here are the buckets of features, rate which ones are most important to you. And then sometimes it'll be the third thing, like, here, look at this ad and give us your reaction to it. And
right.
You can tell that the words that I've picked are the words that are being used in the copy of the ad. And there are times when I'm like, oh, they meant something different by that word than what I said, because suddenly, like, this ad doesn't appeal to me at all, but they clearly think that it would based on my answers to the previous things.
That sounds like a pretty smart way to do science. They want to test whether they have
yeah.
the good model of you or not. Because if you reject the configuration based on what they thought your preferences were, then obviously they got them wrong. And what they're mad about is not your individual, but it's the complex configuration they really care about. So that's clever. But boy, you get a life. That's what you do for fun, to answer surveys? See, she's one of these folks over here. Right? Value of my time? Whoa. Value of free stuff? High. Right? You're one of those buckets. We'll give you a name for that. You know? People who do Mechanical Turk probably in that category too. Right? Okay. All right, let's talk about personas. Because this is the other universe that's of those things you're taught if you take user centered design courses. The idea being that we want to invent some kind of user model, okay? A prototypical type of user. And typically, they're fairly concretely designed to have some rich amount of detail so you can distinguish different personas from each other clearly, okay? The idea is that a persona, because of its precision and detail, preserves details that would get washed out if we were to focus on kind of a more simply defined user category, like gourmet people or cheap people or whatever. But having a very rich model, you tend to remember more of the features, and you can focus more on those when you're making design decisions. And in particular, personas are kind of used as a shorthand. So different people in a design team, different stakeholders in a design company or situation would be able to refer to some bundle of user characteristics in a very simple, direct way. This is not a new idea. It was popularized it goes back to 10 or 20 years in design. It was popularized in a book in 1999 that was called, anyone know? The Inmates Are Running the Asylum. I don't understand that title of that book, but that's the title of the book that everyone uses as the persona book by Alan Cooper. The Inmates Are Running the Asylum. And this is the book that explains this persona technique, and many people will use that book if they take a class like 213 and 214 here at the iSchool. So, this is supposed to be a good idea for the following reasons. We said some of these things before. It warns against simplistic notions of user types like novices versus power users, artists versus techies, so on. It keeps designers from imagining themselves as the user because there's so much detail that they're so different than you can't imagine you could take that person's role. And it helps communicate some notion of who the design is for. I like the idea of a persona because it really helps traceability with something I'm pretty strong on that says, why do we have this feature? We have this feature because the Kimra persona would love this feature. We designed this for Kimra, okay, or for Kate. You have these notes that these personas out there and we're designing for them because we know that they have a particular set of goals or values or preferences and they would like this thing we're doing for them. So we often say, we do it because our most important personas are the Kate persona and the Kimra persona. What they want is going to be our first priority features. Okay? And it's, so again, it helps this idea of traceability. Let me show you some examples. Many of the projects that are done in the iSchool, especially ambitious ones that end up being like master's projects, design rich set of personas. It's part of what you do in 213 or 214 if you take those classes. Here's a project called iNaturalist, which is a site which basically builds a way for people to collect data about the natural world and share their observations. So iNaturalist.org, let me actually show you what that looks like first as opposed to the personas. iNaturalist.org is a site that's still there, I think. And you can essentially create observations about birds or mushrooms or whatever it is that you look at in the world. And you can tag them and make notes about them and put them on the map and all that kind of stuff. So it's sort of a flicker for physical observations of the world. So I can say, here's an observation made by Kenichi Ueda. I think he was the student who was the person. He's the one who actually built this. He's still tagging to the site. It's nice he hasn't given up on his own site. Took a picture of a bug, a sun spider, and he you know, there it is. So he said, I observed this thing 2 days ago, took a picture of it, and I tagged where I saw it. Okay? So that's his site. It lets you, you know, search for things with similar tags and so on and so on. When they built this, they did personas, and they have a number of them. Here's their homework assignment from that class. And here you see Adam and Ted. I want you to look at these guys for a minute. Can you read these? Okay. So Adam is an instructor in trip leader with one of these outward bound kind of things, and he takes people on adventure tourism trips. And he's kind of a techie. And he really likes mushrooms, sort of. And he has a Friendster profile, and he likes to send email and whatever. Okay, so that's what he is. He likes to show people about nature, and he likes to take occasional pictures and so on. As opposed to Ted Sinclair, who is a bird nut, who is the president of his local bird watching society, who keeps reports about sightings of every bird he's ever made in his life, and he makes maps about the environments in which he's seen scarlet tanagers over the last 37 years, and he plots their trajectories based on global warming data, and he writes very detailed notes about everything. Okay? So, these are two kinds of personas that they invented. And of course you ask yourself, where do these people come from? Okay, where do these personas come from? How do their goals differ? And can you actually use these personas to make design decisions? So that's the question, right? So they observed people, they interviewed people, and they said, let me invent two hypothetical people, Ted and Adam, and I'll make them into my personas, two of the three personas. And the question you ask is, how do they differ? How will they differ with respect to a system like this? I gave you kind of the persona. How would Adam differ from Ted in his desire to collect data?
Depending on if he leads trips internationally, he might have more of an interest in just international data, versus Ted might be just looking at, you know, bird patterns throughout the world, migration patterns.
Okay. Or Ted could be looking at everything in his neighborhood to the nth degree. So again, the point is, Ted is going to be much more careful than Adam. Adam is going to be more opportunistic, occasional. He may take a picture, may not. Ted's out there with his Nikon, you know, with 800mm camera all the time on his neck, right? Bang, 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 taking pictures. And he's always trying to find the perfect picture of every bird and doing every possible behavior. You got the idea? So you can imagine that they're going to have different kinds of needs for feature support. Okay? And in particular, they were in one of my classes. They did part of this work in my document engineering class, which is the precursor of this. And so while I did the personas in 2013, in my class, I made them do different data models that would reflect the data model leaded by a casual observer versus that made by a professional observer, how they would differ. You know, they'd want different meta models for their observations, right? Because one would care about things like authoritative metadata. One would care about, here's a big text blob, right? That kind of thing. So you have different interfaces for that, and so on. So in fact, it's quite, you know, there's a technique that's taught about how to do this, and it says, you know, find some potential users, maybe you'll observe them for a while. What are the key characteristics that differentiate them? And then, using your kind of common sense notions, capture this, what you learned about them in this kind of hypothetical person. Because in fact, those people are not real people. The funny part is they go and they say, I want to have, so this guy is the outward bound guy, this guy is the bird nut, and then go try to find pictures of people they can pretend are those people. So these people on these pictures are not Adam and Ted. They're people they found in Flickr or someplace else. And they said, we're going to call you Ted and Adam. Okay? They might be their friends, but they're not Adam and Ted. They may be somebody else. Okay? Point is, you assign details to them, so you say, you know, Adam, because he's a stylish kind of trip leader, he likes to wear fancy Patagonia clothes. So he looks like he's a successful tour guide with fancy gear, right? He has a new travel bag made out of, you know, rich Corinthian black leather. He loves that black travel bag, right? Whereas Ted's got this beat up bag he's had his entire life, this brown backpack from his Boy Scout days, but he's got He's been fixed 17 times by the local guy who sews all kinds of stitches all over it. He's got patches on it from all of his trips. You know, his, whatever it is, right? So you get the idea that all this texture you invent, okay? And then you use this persona as a kind of a checklist when you make a design decision saying, what would Ted want? What would Adam want? That's the way you do personas. But Gruden raises some interesting objections about this method. He says, you know, sometimes you get so carried away with the act of making a persona that you forget what the purpose of the persona was. You say, I got all this rich detail, but, you know, does it really help me make decisions? Does the fact that Ted has this ripped up blue backpack, how does it help us decide what feature to give Ted? Yeah. Now, it may be useful to communicate Ted, saying Ted's this rich person, but does it really give you a way to make a design decision? And if you spend so much time making personas up, you may lose time that you should have been spent doing something else. So, Gruden has, his Microsoft research has helped Microsoft improve its persona making process and design by giving them more systematic and valid techniques for making personas at Microsoft. So Microsoft now has uses a combination of market research and traditional persona techniques to develop proto-personas based on market segments identified using these market research techniques. So they say, which are important market segments that we should then flesh out as personas? So you use data to generate possible personas, and you only enrich after you have a foundation of sort of market objective data that's going to be the rest, the foundation for the personas. Okay? They also make anti-personas, which some people call exclusionary personas, to say, you know, what are we not building for? So we're not building for Irene. Irene is this persona who is somebody that these properties, we don't use it. If Irene would like it, we don't want to make it. Because Irene is like our negative persona. Okay? That's kind of useful. And you really use a persona which is kind of, because they're all standard in a way, they can be much more readily reused across engagement. So Microsoft has a library of personas that they use across all their product line. And it's much bigger than you might think. So here is, in fact, the persona foundation document, table of contents, or the meta model. It says personas should have an overview, a day in the life, work activities, household leisure activities, goals, fears, computer skills, you know, demographic, technology, so and so. So every persona has the same set of characteristics, which makes them easier to reuse and compare and make decisions about possible features or designs. Okay? And again, the as a result, there is a lot more, just generally, there's a lot more rigor at Microsoft on personas than there is in any place else I've ever seen. Okay? So the key questions about personas are, I think, how relevant should your own experience be? That's actually kind of a controversial topic, because if you say, I don't want designers to design for themselves, right? But, you know, does that mean everything you know about yourself, is it relevant in the design of a system? Okay? How much detail should a persona have? Okay? How much of it should be kind of hard data based on this kind of market research versus things you learn by more qualitative or more intuitive means? Should they be fixed or static? Okay? And again, some people have taken this warning that you should never think of yourself as a user to mean that nothing you know is relevant. That's simply flat out wrong. Okay? Because even though you may not have relevant experience about some things, if you're a designer at Nokia in Finland, you can't design for Indian population themselves. You've got to have someone have to tell you what it's like in India. On the other hand, if you can't lift the phone because it weighs 13 pounds, neither can the Indian probably, right? So, you know, you should ignore everything you know about things because you're not the user. Okay? And this often gets, you know, crazy where people ignore their own experiences because they somehow think it's banned. And yet, you know, you're a museum user. Does that mean you shouldn't use that when you design a museum persona? Of course not. Yes?
Just to add to what you were saying, you don't want as a designer to impose all of your views on a design and suddenly become the target user himself. But at the same time, I think one of the things that distinguishes designers from users is that designers are more sensitive to a broad variety of needs
right.
than a particular user would be. So if you're part of being a good designer, I think, is being sort of putting yourself in the place of someone who might be sensitive to things that you as a user wouldn't be, but as a designer can.
Right. No, it's subtle. And again, if you look at this as do this, do this, do this, you can often fall in the trap of saying, I can't trust my own judgment because I'm not the user, which is completely wrong. You're the designer. You may have insight they don't have. That's why you're the designer. Yeah.
This issue reminds me of a joke I heard multiple times at the high school that Apple Computer only has one persona, and it's Steve Jobs.
It could be, right? Again, so but there is the caveat that it really is important that says don't embrace the null hypothesis. Again, that's statistical talk, but it means that don't conclude from your lack of a problem that there isn't a problem for somebody else. Right? So it's, when you do a statistical test, there's a question of whether you have enough power to detect something. So when you hear someone on the news or an ad say, we have found no evidence that this causes cancer, well, you looked in the wrong place. You did a bad experiment, a bad study. It does cause cancer, but you didn't do a good enough study to find it. So you shouldn't embrace the opposite conclusion because you did a bad test. So again, you say, well, I can, you know, make this computer work. Of course I can. You've been doing it for 25 years, you work with computers. So don't conclude that the absence of problems that other people have will have no problems as well. So that is one place where it really is relevant. Avoiding embracing the null hypothesis, where you conclude by things that don't cause problems to you that people won't have problems. Okay. I think the key question is how much detail. And this is where I think I had the biggest axe to grind, because it's really important. And again, I've talked a lot about different contexts of design. Legacy systems versus brand new systems, new product design versus sort of maintenance kind of things. You really want to be able to ask yourself, how much should I invest in this activity? How much do I need to learn about the people and how much of a user model do I need to build? And if you don't have a sense that says, I'm collecting data or I'm building a user model in order to make a better design decision, you'll always do some stereotypical, let me do persona according to the standard way of doing it. It'll be rich and full of detail. And it may not add any value at all to your design decision making. If you have a legacy system and there's three users that have been there for 35 years, they're going to be for the next 35 years till they die, you don't need to make personas. You have the people. Okay? So if you design something for a particular known group of people, you don't do personas. You have them. Okay? They're your customers, right? And so avoid the trap of being saying, if it's we fix, it must be personas in my design work. So again, this and Don Norman rails about this, about when, you know, tell me how knowing about that backpack influenced your design decision. And people go, yeah, but it made it more fun to talk about the people. He said, fine, it's more fun for you as a designer. How to make a better design decision. And just pummels people about this. And I think that he's right in the sense that you have to ask yourself, how much do I need to know? What do I need to do to reduce uncertainty about my design decisions? And you want to invest in activities which reduce uncertainty, not that are gratifying in their own sake. Now, persona making is fun, okay? No doubt about it. But does it make a better design? That's the question you need to ask. Luba.
I think it comes down to the culture of the people you're working with. I worked at a startup where I introduced the concept of personas to them. They had no real sense of who they were, who their target market was. And we went through it, and it was really, really bare bones. And it was just based on the data and just based on their experiences, and then we divided up the target. These
are it probably helped a lot.
It helped a lot.
Right.
If I had tried to start giving them cute names and backstories, it would have been a waste of my time because no one else was interested in that. So I wouldn't have helped anyone.
Right. And that's sensible. That says adapt the technique to the context you're in.
But some people find it easier to talk about cute names than they talk to them about less
experience
with computers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And let's say that they're offering products when they were offering a service before, and they want to understand whether their customer wants backpacks.
Yeah, it could be relevant. Absolutely. Right. All right. But avoid the trap of saying, I must have this kind of detail because personas have this kind of detail when used in this particular way. Again, I think that Gruden makes the point that says, have a meta model that says what kinds of features are likely to be relevant in your design, and have all the personas have the same kind of model that way. Make them consistent, right? So what details are likely to affect people's use of this product or service? Here's a number of possibilities, like, gee, are they old or young? Are they rich or poor? Is it dark with the product I'm using? That's kind of relevant, okay? That's a relevant feature. Do they see well in the dark? Are they short? Are they old? Maybe they can't run up the stairs with a backpack on or something, right? So, again, there clearly are benefits of having a standard meta model. And again, the amount of effort should be commensurate with the scope of what you're doing. Just as Gruden says, you make more character development for a movie than you do for a one-time thing. When I want to say, you know, Kate's acting funny today, all right? I have a model of Kate that I developed over the last 14 weeks or whatever it's been, or 12 weeks or 10. How many weeks has it been? 10? 2? 18 lectures worth, whatever that is. Maybe 10 weeks. I have a model of all of you now. Now, the Lubitz is always going to give me a fight about almost anything. We know this, right? That's what I like about him. All right? He's my, you know, foil. I can always make him get at me like this. All right? So again, it's you have a model, right? But how many do you need in your design problem, right? So most people in the iSchool project methodology, 3 to 5 personas, because that's the way it's done. Why? Because that's the way it's done. Microsoft has 61 on Windows Dynamics alone. There's hundreds of personas in the Microsoft library. They have posters of these things. Persona swag, right? They have it all. They have posters in the hallways of the personas. Okay? Again, this is where it differs slightly from market research. They said, no, let's try to capture the most important variations that may be hard to do if you have actual people. So again, there's a benefit of having these kind of stereotype people. But the key is realism, realistic, not necessarily real. Do they characterize the key dimensions that affect design and preference decisions? Ayush, you have a question? Are you just waving? Hi, Ayush, how's it going, man? All right. Okay. So, I said Microsoft has got this idea of persona, we call it persona swag. They have like persona posters in the hallways. I'm like, go to the design labs and they've got posters on the walls where they have like, here are different people, and they want it constantly reinforced. It's a bad picture because they're taking out a small paper. Constantly reinforced to the engineers who they're building for. So it's like in your face every day that you're walking by, and so you get to know who Irene is or who Sally is. Okay? Now, how do we tie this together to the whole market data thing? Marketing gathers a huge amount of data about customers and tries to figure out, you know, market segments, who's going to buy things. They're mostly focused on buying things, the marketing kind of stuff. And they primarily focus on this sort of demographic things, because those are the easiest things to get out of, like, databases, like from credit bureaus and everything else. You know, where you live, how old you are, where you went to school, okay? And to a lesser extent, these more psychographic things. Those are hard to get out of data you buy from Equiserve or somebody, right? Okay? Whereas personas tend to use more of this richer qualitative stuff because that is closer to the things that designers can get their hands around, you know? Partly because of this idea that you really identify with the persona, you can use it as a shorthand for a rich bundle of things that you can run the model of a persona, kind of like, what would Irene want right here, right? But they have different purposes in the sense that personas can be overlapping. They can have overlapping characteristics, overlapping goals. They may have different ways of achieving them, but they may have multiple overlapping characteristics. Whereas when we do the market research, we're trying to have bins of people who are maximally different. as we talked about trying to sort of fit the curve, saying, let's make lumping a split that we have maximally different groups of people. We can better target that. Okay? So the shorthand would be that marketing says who we're designing for, and personas help us understand more of the why, the intentionality, the goal structure, the deep personality characteristics that will help us understand why people want to act the way they do. So, I mean, they're related, and I think that it may be easier to use a persona in a kind of inspirational way to say, you know, what would this person want? Okay, because it's more generative in a way, right? Whereas the market segments tend to be descriptive of things you actually know. And so you tend to treat them in a more conservative way because you think, I have to rely on the data to get them, so I have to rely on the data to interpret them. Whereas because the personas are more loosely tied to the data, you can, in some sense, use them to inspire ideas about what you want to build in a service or product. So again, you kind of use the personas to explain why the people ended up in the bucket they ended up with when you did the market data, market research. But they're clearly related techniques, and I think that a competent designer should be comfortable with both of them. To be able to say, I need some market research here to give me something to start with. And I think we haven't done very well at that. We tend to have these two different communities of designers where there's the persona makers and then there's the data collectors. And I think we need to do a better job of bringing them together. Okay. Monday, we start two lectures on process modeling. Again, there's a kind of continuum I'm going to try to lay out for you, like I did with the ethnography between the experience intensive and the information intensive continuum. I'm going to break up process modeling in a similar way, starting with techniques which are more oriented toward describing the processes and activities of experiences, or sort of service journeys. Particularly, I'm going to talk about service blueprinting, which is a technique widely used in service operations design with lots of customer-facing touch points to describe both the as-is and a possible to-be process with a set of touch points. I'm going to have you read another paper about lean consumption because it's an interesting philosophy of design of an operational or production system which says, let's make sure we've identified very carefully those activities which add customer value and those that don't, and eliminate aggressively all those activities which don't add customer value. So make the experience as lean as possible, where lean means no unnecessary or redundant activities from the perspective of the customer. And a more kind of geeky way of asking that same question comes from a technique called DSM, Design Structure Matrix, and this is an early paper that explains that. It's going to try to get a qualitative sense of this, not a very rigorous one, because there's a lot of hocus-pocus mathematics in this technique. But the basic idea is that you describe a process, and you look at where there is information exchange or iteration where one step has a feedback into another step. And the idea is that iteration planned or intrinsic, or is it an accidental byproduct which results in wasted effort or rework? So that's related to the lean consumption idea about use this way to model your possible process or service experience journey, and then here's these two kind of conceptual tools that you should use to sort of analyze what you have to make sure you're eliminating all the places which don't add value in your service system. And with that, I think we're done.